Mike Farron, SiriusXM, MLB Network Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, now singing the Mike Farron Open, it's Mike Stibbs.
Just make sure it sounds sexy, Stibbs.
Lord Almighty, how can you stand Arizona? Your fair skin must be burning down into your absent soul. Mike, 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 we can barely hear you. It sounds to me like you called us from inside a hole. But your phone calls lift me higher, like the ERA of Mark Pryor. Your hair looks like it's on fire. You're Mike Farron. You're just a hunk of burning love. You're just a hunk of burning love.
We start today with the sad news in Major League Baseball that Darrell Norman Elvert Herzog, a.k.a. Whitey, has passed away. And you know what? All this time, Mike, I've been watching baseball for 40-plus years. I never knew his first name. I did not know this until I clicked into his wiki. I was like, oh, now I know why they called him Whitey. I mean, it's a very busy name.
Yes. Well, and you'd be so blonde to have your hair be platinum, I guess that makes you Whitey.
Oh, we should call John Whitey then.
I'm just a little bit concerned with all the sun that John's getting in his pasty complexion that he's
going to be
pretty.
I swear to you, there is no sun right now. It is raining here at Haymarket Park.
Well, here's hoping it clears out. I think Whitey Herzog's career is really fascinating, right? So in addition to leading the Cardinals to 3 World Series and winning a championship as their manager and being the first real, successful manager with the Royals, he also was the farm director of the Mets when they won in 69. He was a scout. Nice. He later was the general manager of the Angels. He had a number of different careers. And additionally, he was a very nice, patient man who was willing to teach baseball to anybody who would listen. There's a great story today from Jeff Blair, who's a longtime sports columnist and talk show host in Toronto, who was talking about covering an Expos Cardinals game back in the day, and he was like the backup. And he was just kind of new to the beat, and somebody had suggested that he meet the late Rick Hummel, whose nickname was the Commish, who covered the Cardinals for years and years for the Post-Dispatch. And the Commish was like, come on, let's go see Whitey. And the second day of the series, they went and sat in Whitey Herzog's office, and he basically answered his questions on how to cover baseball for 90 minutes and like why managers make decisions. And that's the kind of guy Whitey was. Like, I don't know if you guys ever dealt with him, John, never. If you ever did, but and he was awesome. So it was a tough day losing him and Carl Erskine passing away too, who was the last remaining boy of some, of the boys of summer from those 1950s Dodgers.
He's
teams.
The last one,
I believe. He's 97. Wow. And Anderson, Indiana native,
and Ken Holtzman too.
Ken Holtzman yesterday, passing away, and that's that's another tie-in with the loss in St. Louis because the Holtzmans were so heavily involved in community sports in St. Louis. Ken and his brother Bob, and his brother Bob is a really good friend, and I believe is the godfather to our friend Danny Wexelman too. So it just a like really rough couple of days for some important baseball figures. Holtzman, this was incredible. I learned this yesterday. No Jewish pitcher has more wins than Ken Holtzman. He had more than Sandy Koufax.
Really? No kidding.
I
would have never guessed that.
Mm-hmm.
Would have never guessed that. The thing, about Whitey, and of course, being a Cub fan, we saw way too much of the Cardinals. But, man, back in the day when you talk about a team that was perfectly crafted for that ballpark and that era, pounding the ball into the turf, outrunning, outlegging hits. Then, of course, the irony of Ozzie Smith hitting a walk-off home run in the playoffs. It doesn't make sense. But it's. I know we sometimes romanticize in sports about how everything seems so homogenized. Everyone uses analytics. Everyone runs the same offense in football. Everyone does this. But, it was – they were a team that kind of stood out. you know, those Cardinal right. teams of the 80s because of the way they played. And you just, you spent any time one of those guys at the top of the order, even at the bottom of the order, got on base, you were just like, oh God, who's going to steal? Who's going to hit and run? You know, you just always kind of felt like you were on edge playing those teams.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like even if you go back to those mid 70s Royals teams, I mean, they were built similarly, you know, with guys mm-hmm. like Amos Otis and then Willie Wilson a little bit later. And, you know, those speed guys where they had the one bopper in the middle lineup, right? They had John Mayberry. The Cardinals had first George Hendrick and then Jack Clark in the middle of those lineups. But yeah, they were built very similarly and very different from, you know, I think what you could do today. You know, I know the Royals like to try and keep some of that spirit of Whitey ball alive with the way they build, but it's a little different playing on grass than it was playing on the AstroTurf. I mean, that was part of what made it so unique, was that they were able to use the field almost as a 10th offensive player, because either chopping the ball high in the air to take advantage of their speed, or you know, when they'd hit a ball in the gap, it would scoot through to the wall, and tons of triples on those squads. And you know, guys like Willie McGee and Vince Coleman and Ozzie Smith were so important. You know, Smith was not a great hitter until he ended up in St. Louis and put together some very good offensive seasons. He had never been much of an offensive player when the Cardinals, you know, traded Gary Templeton for him. Templeton was a much more well-regarded player at that point than Ozzie Smith was offensively. And so, yeah, it's a sad day. And for those of us who are of a certain age, you know, it feels like the loss of somebody who is important. And for Josh, he has no idea who we're talking about.
Nope, definitely not. Hey, Mike, I wanted to ask you, because as we began our regular guest spots with you, which I know you love doing and we
during
appreciate
that whole conversation with John, like, you looked so bored.
I was listening. I like hearing about history. I don't really know a whole lot about what you were talking about, except for I know about the Cardinals and how they ran the base paths because they were really fast, right? Wasn't that the whole thing about the Cardinals? They were fast?
Yes.
All right, so you nailed it. But when we started having you on, Mike, again as a regular guest, we were talking about the Shohei Ohtani story as that was unfolding. Do you think that we are kind of now, I don't want to say like nearing an end game or maybe even past it, but it seems like, you know, the testifying things, reporting, like it seems like we kind of have a lot of the information, and I don't really know how much more we're going to learn. And if you agree with that, I wonder what your takeaway is on everything now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's largely the case. I think the biggest question is if this were to go to trial, which it doesn't seem like it's heading in that direction, but you never know. But with Ibe Mizuhara, you know, cooperating and, you know, surrendering to law enforcement, and it seems headed towards a plea deal, I think we probably are largely to the end of it. I mean, you know, there were a couple things I think that stood out. I mean, one, the lengths with which Mizuhara went to try and isolate Ohtani, not just from his bank account, but from other people who helped to make decisions. Two, the fact that an agency the size of CAA, Creative Artists Agency, which is Ohtani's representative, but it represents a ton of movie stars and huge, did not have anybody who was a Japanese speaker that could relate to Ohtani.
Wild.
Or communicate with Ohtani at all. And so they had to take the word of, you know, like, what's really weird about that is they had to take the word of a team employee, right? Like, that never would happen, you would think, in any sort of situation. And that's not to say that team employees, for the most part, are looking to, you know, screw over the players or not. I don't think that's the case, but there's a division of labor and management there that you would think would be part of it. So I think that's another aspect of it. And I think the other is just the sad state of, you know, Mizuhara being a problem gambler. You know, he ended up $40 million in the hole. And you know, if you read the criminal complaint, it's very clear from it that he was, in essence, telling the bookmaker, the alleged bookmaker, that Ohtani was backing him. And so they had no reason to doubt it. And this is about to be the richest athlete in the world. But, I mean, averaging almost $13,000 a bet, 19,000 bets over a four-year period. I mean, that's somebody who was chasing his losses an awful lot and didn't know how to get out of it. And I don't know if empathy is the right word. I think his actions are, you know, he deserves to be punished for it. But, man, like that's a really, there's a really stark reminder that there is, as much as we have embraced sports gambling, that there is a downside to it that for many people is leaves you feeling like you have to break the law in order to cover the losses that you have.
When Mike, when they had all those numbers come out, and one of it was like the largest bet he placed was whatever, and the smallest was $10. I was like, oh my gosh, that he's averaging that many a day and thousands of dollars, and yet it got so bad that he's like, same. I'm chasing this with a $10 bet. You know, it's like, wow, that's rough.
Well, that may have been the early ones. I mean, he may have been chasing it with $100,000.
Oh, bets, I'm sure, you know, he was.
I mean, that's like, I mean, his gambling winnings were $140 million. His gambling losses were over $180. Like, that's just astronomical.
That is some serious action. I mean, serious yeah. action. On the baseball side of things, I saw a quote from Ron Washington, the manager of the Angels, who was on your network, SiriusXM, and talking about Mike Trout. He said, Mike Trout's having fun, something he hasn't had the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, there was never really any publicized issue between he or Ohtani, but I do wonder if, you know, Trout went from being the singular superstar, then he had to share the spotlight. Now he's back to being the guy again with the Angels. If there is something to that, no. that's a little more freeing for Mike Trout to kind of settle in and be what he used to be at the beginning of his career. And that's
no,
the
he's
jump.
The team sucked and he was hurt a lot. I mean, that's
well, I know he was hurt, but I do wonder if there was a little bit of cycle.
Yeah, no, I don't think there was that. I mean, Trout's not that kind of guy. Trout's pretty. At least in my dealings with him and people I know who've dealt with him, he's a pretty modest dude. You know, he knows he's like those guys who are so great, they don't need to worry about sharing the spotlight or anything like that. There's not, you know, it's not to say that somebody who has that level of greatness doesn't have an ego. He just doesn't need to show it because he knows how good he is, right? So I don't think that was the case. I think it's more because the team has not played well. I think the team has not, you know, has been largely rudderless because he's had significant injuries. That was the interpretation, because I did the interview with Wash. That was the interpretation I took from was that he was healthy and having a good time playing again. And, you know, he's been dominant to open the season, which has been really fun to watch, because I think we wondered if we were going to get one more great Mike Trout season. And, you know, I hope he stays healthy and I hope he keeps it up, because I want to see at least one more great Mike Trout season, and it would be good for us to kind of appreciate it while it's unfolding.
It's scary though, because he's still a relatively young guy, right? I mean, it's
32.
He's not that old.
Yeah. I mean, he's like, really, maybe with the exception of Barry Bonds, I mean, he's the best baseball player in my lifetime. And he's a better defender than Bonds, really. I mean, Bonds was okay in left field. He did not have much of an arm. Trout doesn't have a great arm, but it's better than Bonds. I just, like, Mike Trout is unbelievable. He's just
the shame of it, such a great player. The shame of it is that because he's played for a franchise that has not been very good, and then there was a spell where, and again, I'm not implying that Ohtani was trying to steal any spotlight, but let's face it, he was the biggest star in the game, and so a lot of the focus went on him. And during that same time, Trout was injured. You know, with Bonds, he was always in the headlines, and his teams were always, for the most part, good, especially with the Giants, and so it was easy for him to be worldly recognized, I thought, than Trout. I still wonder if Trout flies under the radar a lot of times.
Well, I think he does because of his personality, but that's
that too.
Not all of those Bonds teams were good. In fact, for a long time, they were chasing, trying to stay relevant while Bonds was good and team was not. So, I don't know that was necessarily the case. I think the other thing is that, like, Ohtani, you know, Ohtani is kind of a keep-to-himself guy, too. I mean, that's part of, I think, where the whole tie-in with Mizuhara having so much access was like, that was his kind of one lifeline. And, you know, I've talked to former teammates of his that said, he was like, we never really got a good feel for who he was. Like, he was cool, but, like, it wasn't like he was joshing around with the boys the whole time in the locker room, like you're, you know, snapping towels and doing all that. So I think he was a little bit more keep to himself as well, and maybe even more introverted because of the language barrier than what Trout is, who's not, you know, like, Trout's a easygoing guy, great teammate from what I understand, but not a guy that's like out there rah-rah in the center of attention, middle of the room type.
Mike, Ken Rosenthal had a really interesting story this morning on The Athletic about Max Meyer and his demotion, and obviously that brought about the service time manipulation conversation. I wonder how much of an eye you're keeping on just this story in general and what's going on with Max.
I'm not really, because I think the bigger issue here is that Meyer missed, what, almost two full seasons coming back from Tommy John surgery. So I think it's, you know, listen, the Marlins are, what, 3-14 to open the year after making the postseason. And I understand Marlins fans being upset at having a guy who has been their best pitcher demoted. But they're also trying to, you know, we just spent last week, most of our time was talking about elbow injuries, right, and guys getting hurt. Yeah. And I think one of the things that they're attempting to do is keep him in a more controlled environment where they can manage his innings better than you can at the big league level, where, you know, the big leagues are really supposed to be, unless you're, I guess, in the depths of a rebuild or just really bad, it's supposed to be a binary outcome, right? You either win or you lose. Nothing else really matters. In the minor leagues, winning and losing doesn't matter. It's about development. And so they can protect Meyer better in the minor leagues. Now, we can certainly debate whether or not continuing to go down this road where we limit pitchers is actually healthy for them, seeing as they keep getting hurt at a pretty high rate. And we do know that there's that old line about the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, which does feel a little bit like where we are in pitcher development. But I don't think that this was, I mean, I think Rosenthal did a really good job of outlining like why it's not service time manipulation. It's not like it's going to cost him arbitration. He wasn't going to be a super two. You know, he's got a, which is, you know, there's a percentage of players with more than two, but less than 3 years of service time to get into arbitration faster. It's like 22% or something like that. And so like, it's not that, to me, it's not service time manipulation. I mean, it's like, some of this stuff is gets thrown around. Like the service time manipulation absolutely happened under the previous CBA, but it happened with the potential star level players that weren't going to sign early career contract extensions, because that ensured that the teams would get an extra year out of them. But for the most part, with the prospect incentive program that you know allows guys like Jackson Holliday coming up when he can still get a full year of service time, if he wins a Rookie of the Year award, the team gets a draft pick, the risk is far less for teams to be able to do that. And so I don't think that it's nearly as big an issue, and I don't think it's the case with Meyer, just like it wasn't the case with Esteury Ruiz. You know, Ruiz isn't a guy that the A's are concerned about getting to free agency. He's the guy who had a lousy approach, and they were going to send him out at the end of spring training, but they had an injury, and so they had to wait until they could fill that roster spot before they sent him. And now he's back and he homered last night, but I think that's, you know, not everything is service time manipulation. Sometimes guys just need to go to the minor leagues for, you know, reasons to either protect them or to you know, for them to improve.
And sometimes service time is great motivation to turn players into National League MVPs and win World Series for woebegone franchises. I'm a big fan of service time manipulation.
Yes, I figured you would be.
You speak of the Marlins, but there is a lower bar to be set in Major League Baseball, and the bar is now the Chicago White Sox. This from White Sox fan and off-tweeter Jay Kuda, who had these wonderful stats for us today. The White Sox, who got shut out last night by the Royals 2-0, have joined the 1907 Brooklyn Superbas as the only major league teams in history to be shut out six of their first 16 games.
Is that bad?
pretty bad. Also, welcome to the Big East, White Sox.
Oh, unreal.
Since opening day,
you.
The UConn men's basketball team has more wins, four, than the White Sox do, two. This is, I mean, it's hard to believe.
This means you're going to start rooting for the White Sox now, right?
Since I have
for
to
all
now.
The Big East teams?
I have to. It was 3 years ago. This team won 93 games. They looked like they had a lot of momentum. They had a lot of good young talent, and there was a general consensus that, hey, in the wake of the Cubs, you know, kind of going in the tank, here come the White Sox. They're ready to take over the city, and they have gone downhill fast. Yeah. How much of this can we just blame on Jerry Reinsdorf?
I mean, I think everybody shoulders a bit of responsibility for this. I mean, I think there were probably some moves that they could have made to push in the talent level and the depth that they needed, you know, over the last several years. But I don't know how much of that is from a budget that Jerry Reinsdorf sent and how much of that was the recommendations of what had become a largely dysfunctional management team. I mean, I've known both Rick Hahn and Ken Williams for a long time, and I like both of them a great deal. But I don't know that it was a great working environment anymore. I mean, there were stories of, the team president undercutting the general manager not having an idea that he had done that. There were a lot of different people that were making moves. Obviously, it kind of started down this road when ownership decided that they really wanted them to hire Tony La Russa instead of AJ Hinch. And I would think that they're probably, we're talking about a little bit different ending to this story, you know, not that Tony, you know, Tony's a great manager, like one of the all-time greats. I mean, but, you know, he also was close to 80 years old, and Hinch was kind of the right guy, perfect for that situation. And then they've also had injuries, you know, like that. I mean, Eloy Jimenez has had a lot of injuries. Luis Robert was really only healthy last year. You know, Yon Mankata's hurt again. Andrew Vaughn hasn't developed. You know, they've had pitching injuries. They started service time. Like the Garrett Crochet thing is, it would be infuriating to me as a White Sox fan. He's establishing himself as this really electric starting pitcher, but because the White Sox rushed him to the big leagues in 2020, they only have 3 years left before, including this year, before he hits free agency. Like, it's just like he's not going to line up with their next window of contention. And they were so set on changing the culture in the clubhouse that they eschewed talent for guys who were good dudes. So I think, you know, Tommy Pham coming up is going to be when they've signed him to a minor league deal. I think he's going to have a big impact on the young players as those young players matriculate to the big leagues over the course of the year and helping them get prepared and teach them what's acceptable for a big leaguer and what isn't. But man, it's going to be rough here this season for the White Sox. I mean, I thought they were going to be better because their defense was going to be better and their pitching looked like it was better aligned, but man, that's a bad offensive team right now.
Oh, my heart goes out. But I do want to end. I do want to end on a superlative because I did promise this Royals fans. But from Codified Baseball, the teams whose chances of making the postseason have changed more than 5% since the preseason.
Never tell me the odds, John.
And
never
look
tell
at
me the
top
odds.
Of the standings. The Pirates and the Royals have improved their playoff chances by 18%. Sadly, the Yankees are also on this list, and the Brewers, and the Royals, or in the Orioles, who were already, you know, many considered a playoff team. But there you go, Royals. And by the way, I saw a number. I think they hit their 11th win last night. I think it took until something like May 10th to get their 11th win last year. So you're a month ahead of schedule there, Kansas City. Yeah.
I mean, it's too early to tell as to whether or not the Royals.
That's what I was looking for.
But the more they get to play the White Sox, the better things are going to be for them.
I was going to ask, you know, maybe if the Royals have been taking advantage of a very pillowy, soft SEC non-conference schedule.
Does feel like they have been playing a lot of midweeks against teams with RPIs in the 250s.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. But as always, Mike Farron, too early.
Too early to tell.
Too early to tell.
All right. Rain has kind of let up here, kind of. I can still see a little bit of it. But by God, the good folks here at Nebraska have already brought me my notes and stuff. I mean, we're playing ball tonight. Somehow, some way, we're playing ball tonight here.
Baseball.
I saw that UNO got washed out. They're supposed to play Kansas today, right? So.
Yeah, but was that in Omaha or down in Lawrence? So it might be.
That was here. In Omaha.
Oh, it was here? Okay.
Yeah, so.
Well, now. Of course, it's
windy.
It's a little shorter drive if you have to cancel and turn around from Omaha to Lincoln, so that's probably
that's true.
Who knows? Who knows? Mike Farron, ladies and gentlemen, SiriusXM MLB Network Radio. Thank you, Mike.
All right, guys.
Bye, Mike.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye.
There he is. Goodbye for now. Mike Farron, everyone, joining us as he does on the 42 Degrees The Source guest line. Oh, wow, nice. They even laminated all the rain.
Because they're ready for the rain.
They are ready for the rain.
They did it for the rain.
They are ready for the rain. Hey, the rain's good for my lawn, baby. I didn't have to water today. So hopefully that new grass, if all the robins don't steal it out of the ground first, we'll start to sprout and make my lawn look somewhat acceptable. If I could get it looking half as good as it does here at Haymarket Park, I would be a very happy lawn owner.
Well, that's why you need to get a bird feeder and fill it with grass seed as a distraction. That's the decoy grass seed for the birds, so they don't go.
Yeah,
the
robins aren't going to do that, though. Yeah, that reminds me, we do need to get some bird seed. We have a bird feeder out back. We do need to get some bird seed and some corn for the squirrels.
Nice.
Always like to feed the squirrels so that Wrigley has something to watch as they're climbing the trees and she's going nutso down there. But
nice.
All right. Still to come. Michael Brunt's going to join us.
Lovely.
How many pitchers are we going through tonight?
Got to figure that part out.
And Matt Rhule. Mm. Interesting things to say today, including about how the quarterbacks did in the scrimmage. He also may have had an old man take today.
Brunt's?
No. Not Brunt's.
Oh,
Matt Rhule. May have had an old man take today.
Okay.
And a whole lot more.
Speaking of old men, Steve Sippel joins us later, too.
And Steve Sippel joins us, speaking of old men, on 1620 The Zone.
Nick Grimm for Circus Sports Iowa. Now, they won't have any lines for my video game baseball league, but they do have lines for real-life baseball, both pro and college. With tight money line splits that rarely go higher than a minus 110, they don't keep as much money on large market bets, for example, the Masters that had just happened. And when you're on a nice winning streak, which, let's be honest, can be easy to do during baseball season, they won't limit your account either like a lot of other sports books might. Make Circus Sports Iowa your companion while you watch all of these amazing baseball games. It's the sports book for you if and when you're ready to level up your sports game and bet like a pro anywhere in the state of Iowa. Also, just their customer service is great. There's no AI, there's no chatbots, it's real-life human beings who want to help you to the best of their ability, and they do. You can shoot them an email, or you can tweet directly at them, and they will get you sorted out if there's anything that concerns you. If you or someone you know may have a problem with gambling, call 1-800-238-7633.